Dr. Randy Jackson from the University of Wisconsin. He will be speaking about how can we manage north central grasslands to build soil organic carbon.
Hold your applause, please. Until afterwards. Thanks, John. Interesting talk, Martha. Thank you. Today I want to talk about north central grasslands, but maybe that's a little bit too broad of a title. I really am going to talk mainly about grasslands in Wisconsin. North central region is, of course, a much broader area than that. And I think that the results that I'll talk about today, you know, need to be kept in that context, because grasslands, when I say grasslands in Wisconsin, we are talking about almost exclusively grasslands that are now on former agricultural areas. We don't have but a half of 1% of the native prairie remaining, and it certainly is not going to be available for management other than occasional burning to maintain its overall structure and productivity. So with that as some context, let me just take a minute to thank my co-authors here who did all the work. It's a long list of postdocs, research scientists, and graduate students, and I'm not going to read through the names, but their names are pointed out throughout the presentation. And so any data that's been collected has been collected by these folks, and they just do a fantastic job. That said, it's my fault if I misrepresent it or wave my arms a little too much. Speaking of waving my arms, this talk will be a bit arm-wavy in that I'm trying to give a bit of an overview of how we think grasslands might be managed for building organic carbon, and frankly, it's going to be a bit of a grim story. Why do we want to build soil organic carbon in grasslands? I have this sod house here in a picture that I took when I was in Iceland to remind me that the reason we want to build soil organic carbon in grasslands ranges from the local to the global. And so at the global end, and maybe what I'll focus on here as we move forward, is our interest in taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it below ground to help stabilize climate. But I just want to keep our eyes on the ball here. Building organic carbon, building organic matter in soils has lots and lots of benefits beyond helping to stabilize climate that relate to improving water holding capacity, retaining nutrients and systems to keep them out of aquatic environments, improving productivity over the long term. So there are lots of reasons that we want to build organic carbon in grasslands. And I wanted to show you my picture of a sod house in Iceland, which reminds me of the house that maybe my grandmother lived in Oklahoma at one time. At least that's what she always told us. We lived in a sod house. We still have sod houses in Oklahoma? Anybody here? So I mentioned the global perspective, and no soil organic carbon talk, I guess, would be complete without a depiction of the global carbon cycle. But really, all I want you to focus on is, if I can make the pointer work, all I want you to focus on is this number of the atmospheric carbon net increase, which is 4 petagrams of carbon per year. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read these papers, and I'm not a global guy, and I read these papers and I see petagrams, and I'm like, wow, that's big. I don't really have any way to relate it to the kind of scales that I usually work at, which are, well, my students and postdocs work at, which are small plots. And so throughout the talk, I'll try and relate that to that number to what we're talking about in sort of smaller scales. But I, you know, the big picture here is we'd like to find ways to chip away at that 4 petagram of carbon per year increase. And so I dug into the literature a little bit, as maybe you have, and found this really wonderful article by Hardin et al. That was just recently published that does a little bit better than back of the envelope calculations for why we or whether we might actually be able to improve the management of our ecosystems to help store carbon in a way that would significantly chip away at that 4 petagram number. And so as you can see here on the y-axis of their figure, we have petagrams of carbon per year. And the positive bars there, forestry, crops, and grazing, are their estimates of what might be reasonable estimates of how much carbon could be sequestered in these various biomes with improved management, whatever that might mean. And let's talk a little bit more about what that is here in a few minutes. But you can see here that the combination of forestry crops and grazing, you know, if we could get the kind of gains that they are looking at here, we might be making significant progress at chipping away at that 4 petagram number. Notwithstanding the negative numbers over there, which are projections for continued human land use changes that are going to put more carbon into the atmosphere. So this is not fossil fuel combustion, which is, of course, the elephant in the room. This is continued harvesting of tropical forest, converting that into agricultural land, et cetera. And then, of course, the notorious feedback to permafrost of climate change is another big driver that we have to keep in mind. And keep that in mind as we think about north central grasslands and whether or not they might be sequestering carbon or not. So I guess the takeaway message here is I convinced myself that, yeah, maybe we can do something to chip away at that number of 4 petagrams of carbon per year. I did do some back-of-the-envelope calculations to convince myself that at a plot level that would be something like about 40 grams of carbon per meter squared per year. Okay. So let's get even more arm-wavy here and think about a cartoon depiction of why we think we could actually improve carbon sequestration in any type of ecosystem. The only reason this would happen would be if net primary production, NPP, is larger on average over time than heterotrophic respiration, RH, so microbial respiration. As long as that arrow going in is bigger than that arrow going out, we should be accumulating carbon. And what better place to do that than the upper Midwest or the north central region, especially Wisconsin, where we have a tremendous amount of productivity in the summer during the growing season, and then some excessively cold winters that reduce microbial respiration, that make that RH arrow quite small, compared to other parts of the world, like the South, where these arrows might be more balanced, and so this might be an even harder thing. In fact, the fact that NPP is so much greater than RH over the millennia is why the Corn Belt is in the upper Midwest, because lots and lots of carbon accumulated there under the prairie grasslands. And so when we look at the main drivers of why carbon accumulates in ecosystems, the most obvious and overriding drivers are the climate, the precipitation and temperature regimes, and the combinations of those things. But if you've been here for the last 2 days, I think over half of the talks have been about how it's the soil traits dummy that that really drive how, whether, and when carbon actually accumulates in soils. And you know, for the 20th century, maybe we focused mostly on the physical and chemical side of things, but again, maybe a quarter of the talks this week have been about how we've been ignoring the microbes and all the things that microbial biomass composition, different functional groups of microbes do to help us accumulate organic matter in the soil or not. And what I want to point out here is that I started to draw a bunch of arrows between just the boxes there under soil traits to point out that these things interact to a high degree, and keeping track of all the various combinations of just of soil traits is really, really difficult, really hard work. And then you add arrows between the climate and the various combinations of climate, and the interactions become even more cumbersome. And then we overlay something like management so that we can ask questions about how grazing might be affecting soil carbon. And here, embodied in plant composition, litter quality, and quantity are things like disturbance. So when we graze, we manipulate the amount of the quantity of litter going into an ecosystem. And certainly the dung pats and the excreta have some influence on the quality of the plant material going into the soil. But when we look at the combinations there and the interactions there, it gets even hairier and harder to keep track, at least in my pea brain, of all the possible interactions that are going on. Notwithstanding then what happens once that carbon enters into the soil organic carbon pool, the big soil organic carbon pool. And here's just a really simplistic way that we used to think about how carbon is situated within the soil organic matter. But as I've heard yesterday from several folks, this is an antiquated way of thinking about it now, and this is really the frontier of our research, is how to understand how these where the carbon goes once it gets into these pools. So this is, as I said, a cartoon depiction, kind of getting at like why this is such a messy topic, why it's so hard to predict. We don't really have models that do a great job of keeping track of all these combinations, and I'll argue that we need to continue refining those models. So let's set aside models for a minute and just look empirically at what the data tell us. These are data from Howard Skinner at Penn State in 2008, and I show this to my class every year, and I never get tired of looking at this figure and staring at it. I showed it to my 17-year-old daughter as I was practicing this talk, and she said, "Dad, this is too complicated." I said, "These are scientists, honey. They're going to be able to hang with me on this." This is net ecosystem exchange, which is a carbon exchange above the canopy between the plants and the atmosphere with eddy covariance techniques. And the top graph on the left is an almost continuous measurement of carbon flux in the bottom in grass and cool season grasses in Pennsylvania, which are similar to cool season grasslands in north central region, and then alfalfa on the bottom. And so the whole point of the left graph is just to show you that they do this on a continuous basis, and then they aggregate it up on the right-hand plot. And the right-hand plot has a whole bunch of lines, but the ones I want you to focus on are the filled-in squares, the black squares. That's the balance of daytime and nighttime net ecosystem exchange in grass. And what I want you to focus on is that when that line with the black squares goes above the dashed line of zero, that's the part of the year when the grassland is accumulating carbon. That's when it's a net sink. When it's equal to zero, then of course it's zero. And when it goes below that dashed line, it's a net source of carbon to the atmosphere. And so here are really productive cool season pastures in Pennsylvania in a climate that should be ideal for sequestering carbon. And I use the word precarious here. Look how precarious the months of April and May are, just sitting there waiting to be undermined. The period of time when carbon might actually be accumulating is just sitting there waiting to be undermined by an overgrazing event. Maybe fertilization would improve things. The point here is just that there's really this sort of short period of time when this ecosystem is a potential net sink. And so if we do something to it that undermines its ability to do that, then it's going to be a net source. Interestingly, my colleague Chris Kucharik at UW-Madison has been studying how the climate has been changing locally in Wisconsin. And the big takeaway message from that work is, well, the growing season isn't really changing that much, but the winters are getting warmer, especially at night, and the springs are getting warmer, especially at night. And both of those times, when the winter is getting warmer and the spring is getting warmer, coincide with periods when there's not any plant growth going on. In fact, what we're doing is undermining the ability of the system to accumulate carbon, because we're accentuating the bottom line there, which is the nighttime. That's when microbes are doing their thing. And so we're stimulating the microbes at periods of the year and periods of the day when there's no plant uptake. And so this has some significantly grim ramifications for these ecosystems' ability to build carbon. So I mentioned that in grasslands and all these ecosystems that we'd like to improve management to try to help these systems build carbon. Richard Connett published this paper recently in Ecological Applications, sort of taking stock in a meta-analysis of various approaches to doing this in grasslands. And so this is a global meta-analysis. And you can see there's a lot of focus on things that improve productivity of the plants, that improve MPP, fertilization, improved grazing, whatever that might be, sowing legumes. These are all things that over and over people have shown if you stimulate productivity, carbon should accumulate. not so much research effort into earthworms and irrigation and sowing grasses, but at least sowing grasses and earthworms show that there's some tremendous potential for accumulating carbon. I put down here at the bottom this 50 grams of carbon per meter squared per year, that's the sort of gain that we'd be looking at to get to that 4 petagram number. And then below the dashed line here are things that are less about improving grasslands, but improving cropping systems, so taking agricultural land and moving it, say, into a perennial grass system. And of course, there's been a lot of research showing that converting native systems, whether they're grasslands or forests, is not a net gain. Don't do it. But converting agricultural lands into perennial systems could be a real boon for soil organic carbon accumulation. So that's what the meta-analyses say, but what do the data say? And so I promised you some data from Wisconsin. These are data from a project where John Steyer and I planted several different grassland plots into what had been a turf grass. So you can see the turf grass in and around the actual plots there. And then we just let them grow. We did some fertilizing, we did some mowing. We came back 2 years later, and the top panel shows that between 2004 and 2006, we thought by then they should be accumulating carbon. They had all lost a significant amount of carbon, except for, of course, the highly invasive reed canary grass, which held on to whatever carbon was in the soil. And when I say they lost carbon, they lost about 200 grams of carbon per meter squared per year. Keep in mind that 40 grams of carbon per meter squared per year is what we'd like them to accumulate to help get to that 4 petagram number. So they lost a lot of carbon in the first 2 years, which made us think, we must have messed up these numbers. Let's go back next year and do it again, which is the middle panel. In the 3 year difference, you can see they had lost almost another 200 grams of carbon per meter squared after being sown. And then by the third year, which is the bottom panel, some of the plots had started to maybe come back and get to the numbers that they were before. Some of them not so much. There was no clear effect of these disturbance treatments or fertilizer treatments, the mowing and the fertilizer. But the takeaway message is that there's at least this short-term carbon debt that you incur when you sow grasslands, when you improve management by putting in what should be more productive grasslands. And so that's something to beware of. Here's a gratuitous photo of me. What I want you to take away from this is that I'm not a fly-by-night Dodger fan. I'm a real Dodger fan. I was up last night late watching my Dodgers. And that I'm not fly-by-night because I have my Brooklyn Dodger hat on, although I was not a Brooklyn Dodger fan when they were in Brooklyn. The other thing I want you to take away is that this is about as close as I get to the actual research plots. I'm trying to tell people, you guys come in here and get the sampling done. But really, that's a silt loam that's occasionally burned. It's a highly productive restored grassland. It had been in place for about 10 years. The picture on the bottom right is a less productive loamy sand that was occasionally grazed by bison. When I say occasional, I mean like every couple of 3 years over the history of the project. And it was largely the same species composition, at least at planting time. And only about 50 miles away from the other site. And what I want to point out here is that we've put on the x-axis the ratio of warm season to cool season grasses, C4 to C3 grasses, and we're asking the question, does that ratio really drive whether or not a particular plot accumulates carbon? And the answer was, it depends. It depends on if you're on the productive site, in which case you can squint really hard and draw a positive line through that cloud of points that are really being leveraged by a couple of plots up in the upper right-hand corner that were almost completely dominated by big bluestem. But nonetheless, even plots that had a low amount of C4 grasses in those gray, highly productive prairies were accumulating a significant amount of carbon, upwards of 400 or 500 grams per meter squared per year. Whereas these loamy sand, low productivity sites were hovering right around zero. Some were positive, some were negative. Whether this is due to the grazing or the sandiness, we don't know. But the takeaway point is here, we can't just make a blanket recipe for accumulating carbon and say, if we plant grasslands, it'll come. The way we manage it matters. The way the soils underneath it are matter. Maybe not surprising. These are results hot off the presses that Greg Sanford, a research scientist in my lab, put together. This is 5 years after we planted bioenergy crops. So these are warm season grasses and other types of crops. I guess I want to focus mainly on the grasses. And after 5 years, we took soil carbon at the beginning. We took soil carbon after 5 years. And frighteningly, none of the systems are accumulating carbon, whether it's native prairie on the far right there, switchgrass, the second from the left there, native grass mixes, successional systems. None of them are accumulating carbon. And in fact, at depth, below 25 centimeters, they're all losing significant amounts of carbon. So this is 5 years on after planting these perennial grasses. These results mimic, or mirror, I should say, results from the Wisconsin Integrated Cropping Systems Trial, which is another place where we restored prairies. On the left, you see tenure restored grasslands. After 10 years, those grasslands were hanging on to whatever carbon was in the system. You can see that the grain systems over there were losing upwards of 500 grams of carbon per meter squared per year. The pasture was the closest we got to actually accumulating carbon. In fact, if we look only at the surface 30 centimeters, they were accumulating carbon, but when you incorporate the depth to 90 centimeters, they were just holding on to whatever carbon was in the system to begin with. And when we graze cool season grasslands, we see the same sort of dynamics. We apply rotational grazing as a form of improved management. In 2006, you can see that the rotational grazing, which is the second bar over, held on to carbon at a higher degree than the other treatments, which were continuous grazing and harvesting hay. And in 2007, we actually accumulated some carbon. But the point here is that there's a lot of temporal variability. So climate, soils, and management interact. It's hard to make any sort of blanket statement about the ability of grasslands to accumulate carbon, even in a region that is set up for accumulating carbon. And I think I'll leave it at that. I'd be happy to take questions and stay for the panel discussion afterwards as well. Thank you.